I think what you're saying is, I don't know if I've ever heard it framed that way, but it's so accurate. You know, there's some kind of transmission that we receive around being around other men, specifically within the context of nature, you know, and when we get ourselves out of the sort of corporate environments or the city dwellings and into this sort of like raw and primal environment, I think the way you said it, there's this like, you're a part of a hidden conversation, I think is what you said before. And I think that we as men yearn for that in some capacity. So I would love for you to talk a little bit more about what role do you think initiation plays within a man's life? What do you think maybe is the side effects of not having that initiation? And then what are some of the important elements that you received through your initiations? Because it sounded like you went through maybe a few of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the case. I mean, one is a few things just happen when you go into nature. The first is that a real life sense of consequence becomes directly tangible to you. And when that, and you know, for example, when I was 10 years old, my father and I went out to hunt an impala, and we found ourselves lying on a termite mound, and I took a shot and the impala sort of scattered. My father said, "Stay here and let's just see if that animal has gone down." And while we were lying there, you know, I felt this movement across my leg, and I looked down and there was about a 3-meter black mamba crawling over the back of my leg.
Oh my gosh. And
I grabbed my father. I said to him, "Shit, Dad, there's a mamba." And I knew snakes. I was about 10 years old. I said to him, "Don't move, don't move." And he looked around thinking I had seen it somewhere. And he sort of went, "Well, where is it?" I said, "Don't move, it's on us." And we lay there for about 3 minutes as this snake crawled over us. And I remember looking across at my father and he had blood coming out of his mouth. He was biting the inside of his cheek so hard that the blood had started to flow. But in that moment, and I think of that snake as an initiatory moment, in that moment, it's all right there. One, there is direct consequence. Two, there is a responsibility to transcend your natural patterning, which is just to freak out and run. You have to go beyond that. You have to find the place in yourself where you want to freak out, but you have the capacity to react accordingly. So you're teaching yourself to be more with what the moment is requiring. There was this sense of being in a very dangerous situation with my father. And all of those things together had have a kind of effect. And eventually the snake crawled a little bit away from us and he grabbed me and we ran over the top of the mound through a thorn bush. And I remember he tucked his head and we blasted through the thorn bush and we came out the other side and he had like a giant antler where a thorn had broken off in his face. And as I look back on it now, that was a very deep initiatory moment into consequence, into real life, and into humility instantly. A sense that, you know, there is a world around me that is far beyond me. And I think that I think of that too sometimes as you sit around a fire as a man, as night falls in the wilderness. And as it falls and a lion roars nearby, or you can feel a bear out there, there's an instant sense of humility that is put in you. Mm-hmm. And that humility is a different way of looking at the world. And we lose track of it when we're trying to build ourselves to the top of the ladder or dominate or crush this game or crush this work. Or, you know, we forget that, in fact, we will be humbled in life. And if we're humbled sooner, we can live from a deeper and more different place. And it's a more connected place. So it brings us into belonging. It brings us into tangibility. I think what a lot of men are suffering from now is like, just a lack of the tangible. You know, things happen all day in digital realms and you get to the end of the day and things have happened, but you haven't actually seen things happen. Whereas when you're in nature, you know, there's something about collecting the wood, making the fire, it brings you into presence. And that presence is actually very, very nourishing. Mm-hmm. So I'm rambling a bit, but the natural world, just by being in it, takes us into all of those dimensions of what makes a man feel solid and whole and in tune with mortality and in tune with consequence. And it's beautiful. You know, when I run these retreats, we'll have one night where we'll leave the camp and we go and sleep on the ground. And if a lion pride walks through that night, the person who's keeping watch has to see them. There's no vehicle, there's no tent, and we will have to handle that together as a group. And what's incredible is, without working too hard, come the next day, that group is incredibly bonded and conversations start to open at a deeper level and men start to share at a different level. And you don't have to work so hard to break through the guards and defenses. It's like the stars and the moon and the real danger, the real fact that we rely on each other when we're sleeping out there on the ground, and a sense in ourselves of like, oh my God, it's dark out here. And all of that brings us more into a more truthful place with who we are. And we stop the bravado, we stop the bullshit, we stop the act, and we can finally just say like, we are all at the same level out here. Let's open up.
Yeah, I remember camping as a kid, and I grew up in Northern Canada. So there's not lions, but there's grizzlies, right? And grizzly bears grizzly bears are a real problem. And there's moose, which moose in real life are terrifying. They're like these monstrous things. You see photos of them and you're like, oh, that looks cool. Looks big. And then you see one in a bull moose in real life and you're like, holy shit, that thing is huge. And I remember camping as a teenager, and we were outside in tents, and we could hear a bear not too far from us. And all the guys are out of the tents immediately. We're probably like 15, 16 years old, and we're all out of the tents immediately. And we're like trying to make a plan, you know, what's going on? Does anybody have a gun? Does anybody have a knife? Does anybody have bear mace? Right. Yeah. And this conversation is unfolding because we had sort of gone off into the wilderness solo. And it's wild how that type of experience where you can't help but come face to face with the largeness that is the world, and the smallness of you and the frailty of us as human beings. There's something so humbling, you know, it sort of reduces our arrogance and this ignorance that we sometimes carry that we can conquer and dominate everything. It eradicates it in a moment, you know, and it's just a heartbeat.
In a moment. And, you know, when that bear is sniffing around out there, you're having an encounter with yourself. You're having an encounter with that animal, but you're also having an encounter with yourself. And if young men don't have guided encounters with themselves, if we don't have an opportunity to have an encounter with ourselves, we're left wondering. And it's the wondering, who am I under pressure? Who am I in the face of it? Who am I? That then results in this reckless pushing in the wrong directions or this constant attempt to prove. And so the more opportunities you have to work out, who am I in the face of real life, real adversity, all of that stuff, the chip that you feel of someone who's got a lot to prove comes down because you actually have more of a sense of who I am in those spaces. That's why, you know, the classic example is, that's why martial artists are never aggressive people, because they know. It's the one who's still trying to work out, have I got it? That's where the edges always are. The knowing gets established through more encounters with yourself, knowing where your edges are, knowing how far you can push, finding your grit, finding how you handle fear, finding how you handle the fear of being vulnerable. And that's why those spaces so well guided radically change a man. And that's why the work you're doing is so incredible and important in these times, because it's a lost art form.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, what's interesting is I've become more and more present to the importance. He's almost two. I have an almost 2-year-old son. Mm-hmm. And I think I went through a bit of a period of being so focused in on career and building. And when my son was born, all of a sudden, this sort of very primal urge came back online. Go out in nature, take men, you know, deeper into nature. And so like this year, everything that we're doing is just outdoors, you know, in Zion National Park, in Olympic National Park. And so just taking men into the depths of the forest and the wilderness. And it sort of was sparked by having my son, remembering my childhood, which was so outside. Everything was outside, you know, whether I was camping or building igloos in the snow or whatever it was. And this sort of emergence of the importance of bringing him through those experiences and the excitement that I had within me to bring him outside. I mean, he's going to be 2 this spring and summer, and I'm like already planning tenting outside, you know, and taking him camping. But I wanted to circle back on this initiation, I think, with the Shangan trackers, and kind of get a sense of, what did you take out of that? What did you start to learn about tracking? Why was that so important? And how did that fit into maybe initiation for you personally?
You know, it was deeply initiatory for me. And the beautiful thing about it was the Shangang people, they allowed me to be with them. And it was through the share, the being together, that I slowly started to learn how the process works. And I think that that's a missing piece. It's not like they were like, okay, now we're going to take you and teach you. It's just the consistent ability to be and to watch and to observe. When I made mistakes, they would never scold me for making mistakes or tell me or judge me. They would just slowly adjust me. Mm. And as I started to learn the skill through shared presence, through being with them, I started to get more and more confidence. You know, there's like, it's just something so beautiful about learning something, starting to know that you're good at it, starting to feel like here's a thing that I can do. It's just such a great way for someone to get solid in themselves, any skill that you learn to do. So it was all of those things. And in some ways it was just, it's hard to say, but it was just being with these guys who were such masters of their craft and learning how they moved and learning how they handled dangerous situations. And then being with them in, you know, we would go out and we would track lions, and, you know, you find the lion would growl at you, and watching how much presence they had. And I think that was, I would say that in some ways that was the biggest thing, is I guess what I saw in them was a different model of power. And they were never trying to be dominant over the animals, dominant over the environment, dominant over me, you the student, I'm the teacher. They were constantly in a state of deep presence. And what I mean by that is they were in tune with what the moment was asking for. And so when it was lighthearted, they were lighthearted. When the terrain became thick and dangerous, their whole energy changed. And they were constantly adapting themselves to that moment. And there was this very deep sense that our well-being was tied to each other. You know, there's this idea in Africa of Ubuntu, which I am because of you. And it's a deep psychological state of relationality. And, you know, somehow my well-being is deeply tied to your well-being. And they expanded that to all of the animals around them too. Mm. And, you know, I remember I was once out with Renius, who was this incredible Shangaan tracker. And we came across a huge elephant bull. And the bull got a fright because the wind changed and we were suddenly too close to him. And he turned and he threw his ears forward and he walked towards us, which an elephant will sometimes do. And he looked at us sort of down his tusks. And for a moment, Renia stood just until the bull stopped. And then as he stopped, he turned and he walked away. And then he stopped again. And then he said to me afterwards, you know, Boyd, I want to show that animal that we respect him and we want to give him his space. Mm. And there was just something, Renius was like that all the time. He was just in a state of deep respect with the world around him. And when you're tracking, you're in a dialogue with the natural world. Birds are calling and that language is telling you something. The ground is telling you a story. The freshness of the tracks and the way that the tracks are laid down are telling you cadence and movement of the animal. It's almost like as you follow the tracks, you can feel the animal. A monkey starts to alarm and that tells you that that animal is even closer. And then a Inyala starts to call and it's all speaking to you. And I think that it was just that type of relationality that really affected me. And in a consumer culture, you know, the individual self is disconnected from the greater whole. Mm. And as a result of that, the search for meaning is reduced to how am I doing in comparison to everyone else? And there's this like comparative dynamic that you live inside of in a consumeristic culture, whereas out there you're in relation all the time. And it's just a different, it's literally a different psychological state.
All right, team, this episode is brought to you by Henson Shaving. And Henson Shaving is a family-owned aerospace parts manufacturer who has made parts for the ISS, the International Space Station, and the Mars Rover. And they are now bringing some of that precision tech into the shaving experience game. So look, I'm going to just break this down for you pretty straightforward. Number one, I don't really love shaving, if I'm really honest with you, because I'm lazy. But what I can tell you is that I really dislike shaving when the razors are crappy. And there are some crappy razors out there that cause a ton of irritation, that get clogged up all the time. If you got like thick, coarse hair like me, they get clogged up all the time. And sometimes whether they're cheap, whether they are expensive, the razors just don't work very well. And for me, I have found a great solution to that, which is Hanson's Shaving. Their razors are awesome. They're phenomenal. They're very quality. I've significantly noticed less irritation on my neck when I shave, which has been wonderful because I generally only shave a couple times a week. I don't do it every single day. So if you're a guy that does it every single day, I can only imagine how much irritation you must go through sometimes. So this is a great option for you to check out, and I will tell you why. If you go to hensonshaving.com, it's hensonshaving.com/mantalks, choose your razor and you will get a year's worth of razor blades for free. They will include, just make sure you add them into your cart, but they will include a whole year's supply of razor blades. And I would love for you to go check it out because I have really, really enjoyed this. It has made shaving much more fun, much more enjoyable, and much easier on my neck. So I'm not getting all of the irritation. So check them out. Let me know how you enjoyed them. Why is it that we have such a aversion to the unknown? Like I feel like sometimes a large part of my job is just supporting people in facing the unknown, being okay with the unknown, accepting not knowing. What does that come from? Is that just a part of human nature? Is it something that we have developed within our culture? Like, can you speak to that?
I think it is part of our nature, but I think it's become exacerbated by, again, being asked to face the unknown in an intolerable circumstance, which is in isolation. We would used to, and we again go back to Cart Cialone, sitting together quietly in the dark. We don't sit together. So I'm being asked to face the darkness alone. I remember the first part of your question has something to do with people feel ineffective when thinking about facing the enormity of what's going on. Well, that's another part of that. Thinking about facing climate catastrophe or cultural collapse by myself, forget about it. But if I can begin to remember that I am part of a cohesive body and collectively we are responding to what's going on, then I begin to feel a little bit more empowered, a little bit more possible that this isn't all on my shoulders. It's on the shoulders of millions, hopefully billions, of people who are concerned about our future. And that collectively, the imagination of the communal, of the species, you know, if we could sit long enough in the dark, quietly waiting for something to occur, we might get some guidance about how to restore our primal relationships to the planet. I mean, one of Jung's phrases is that we are in the trouble we're in because we have neglected the instincts, the age-old unforgotten wisdom that lies at the core of the psyche, the unforgotten wisdom. So there's some deep, archaic part of the psyche that remembers its primal relationship to place and to planet. And I think under this critical time, this is a time that memory is being stirred. But as far as dealing with uncertainty, you know, it's scary. It's very scary to have to face it in isolation. It's much more possible when we can gather in circle and begin to speak about uncertainty. All what uncertainty is indicating is that we have gone as far as the mind can decipher, and we're now living in mystery. And to be able to enter mystery, Garcia Lorca said, only mystery enables us to live. So we're living more into mystery now than into the familiar. And that's precisely where we're heading. The moment you leave the daylit world, the moment you enter the negredo, into the blackness, the daylight sight ends. And now you're required to develop a second sight, a sight that can see in the underworld, that relies less on reason and more on intuition, more on heart knowledge. A deeper perceptual field is required of us now.
Thank you for that. Thank you. You talked about us living in a grief-phobic culture, and I would love to just hear you define some of the territory or parameters of that, what it looks like, and how we begin to traverse that.
What the grief-phobic culture looks like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Look around.
open on Facebook, yeah.
We do not know how to deal with death, with endings, with loss, with failure. I talk about in my book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, the five gates of grief. And really, the only gate that we ever acknowledge collectively is when someone close to us dies, or something close to us dies, or something ends, like a marriage ends, or we lose a home. We can say to someone, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss and my condolences. And we can acknowledge that a little bit. But all the other gates of grief are basically unacknowledged. The losses that happen to our own integrity, when we lose whole portions of our being through shame, through trauma. So we lose our sense of being able to ask for what we need, or we can't show our tears, or we can't show our exuberance or our joy or our sensuality. We lose whole portions of our being. That's a whole gate of loss that we do not acknowledge. The sorrows of the world, we barely acknowledge collectively. The fourth gate is what I call what we expected and did not receive. You know, we are wired to expect the same thing our deep time ancestors experienced, which was life within a contained field of village or tribal culture. We expected 40 pairs of eyes greeting us every day, wondering what we dreamt about last night. We expected to share meals and rituals of grief and gratitude, and we expected to go through some kind of initiatory process. We expected to be under the stars, listening to the old ones tell the stories at night. Almost none of that manifested. That's a deep source of grief that we don't even know how to name, but it feels like a chronic emptiness at the core of our being, which we typically blame ourselves for. What did I do wrong to feel so empty inside? Well, what if that emptiness isn't somehow a flaw in your character, but an absence where a living culture was meant to be flourishing and nourishing you, and then you in turn helping the culture to flourish? And then the last gate I talk about is ancestral grief, the rupture in our ancestral lines, that we all come from intact and ancestral indigenous communities, but most all of us, particularly in white Western culture, that got severed. And that relationship to place, to language, to ritual, to cosmology, again, something that disappeared. And also in that ancestral line is what happened when our ancestors arrived here to the native cultures, to the importation of slavery. That ancestral grief is so thick that the more I work with grief, the more I think that most all of our grief is multi-generational. It's not even mine. I mean, I have my own personal losses, my own personal experiences, but so much of the grief that I carry in my body and you carry in your body began, as Rumi said, in some other tavern. It began generations, thousands of years ago, and has now continued on. And now they're talking about the transgenerational transmission of trauma, right? They're talking about this, the new epigenetics of trauma and how it transfers down the lineage. Now, that's difficult news to hear. The other side of that coin, though, that I think is hopeful, is that it's also the transgenerational transmission of courage, of affection, of love, of creativity, of imagination. Somehow you and I are sitting here having this conversation because that lineage did not get broken. So something endured, not just trauma and grief, but also something that allowed us to have this moment in this flesh, in this bone, in this body. But collectively, again, you go back to individualism and you go back into the archetypal mode of perception. The dominant archetype in this culture is the heroic archetype. And the hero needs no one. The hero is always successful. The hero shows no vulnerability, has no need, rises above everything. We're always climbing. I mean, look how anxious we get collectively when the stock market goes down. I mean, we have entire industries devoted to things, making sure that they keep going up. You know, the whole, you know, erectile dysfunction industry. We hate it when things go down. It's somehow a personal failure when things go down. That's the time we're in right now. We're in a time of descent. And that is soul time. Soul has all to do with descent and with going down. That is holy ground to the soul.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's what I took out of that is the importance of allowing ourselves individually, collectively, communally to enter into those spaces of grief when they arise, and to actually get curious in some ways about the grief that we might be carrying that we haven't acknowledged. And the fundamental and almost undeniable importance of that, you know, I think. And the other thing that stood out to me as you were talking was you know, I read somewhere that 25% of the United States, $27 trillion has been printed off within the last 5 years. And I was like, oh my gosh, like what a great symbol of exactly what you're talking about, right? Prop it up, let it keep going up, ascension, ascension. We seem to be unable to allow ourselves to enter into these spaces of decomposition. So as somebody that has facilitated this, you know, what does that group work look like? What does that grief work look like when you are guiding people through that space? Obviously, you know, you don't need to give us all the details, but what could somebody expect from entering into that space?
Let me first just say a couple thoughts. Please. About it. I'm very concerned about our psychological language that is so conditioned around growth and development and self-improvement. I think it's actually an act of violence at times. I think we are so obsessed with self-improvement because our anxiety around belonging is so pervasive that we think that unless I make myself better, I won't be let into the circle. And so it's often people come into my office, it's often predicated on a degree of self-hatred. I've got to get rid of these parts of me. I've got to improve these parts of me. Otherwise, I'll never be let inside. And I'll always be an outsider. I'll always be in exile. And my first piece of work with them is to begin to stop the war and stop the obsession with growth. Soul doesn't give a shit about your growth. What it wants is full encounter. It doesn't care about failure or defeat or inadequacy. That's part of being in this body. And the soul is fine with that. What it doesn't like is a truncated experience of participation. It doesn't want you to accept only success and neglect and deny and push away failure. Failure, Rumi says, is the key to the kingdom of heaven. So we need failures. There are ways that bring us into humility and into connection with other human beings. It isn't through my strengths that I get intimate with my friends. It's through my vulnerability. It's through my weakness. It's through my frailties. So when we enter into a grief ritual space, it's an invitational field to bring in all of these parts of us, the outcast, others in ourselves, the losses, the defeats, the suicides, the alcoholism. It's a space to bring in what is culturally unacknowledged. And in that field, we build a ritual container strong enough, fierce enough, loving enough for people to side by side when the ritual comes to collectively weep their tears. And what we acknowledge from the very beginning of our time together over our 3 days together is to break the fiction of private suffering. People will share a thread of grief. Then I'll ask, did anybody hear a thread of grief they couldn't relate to? And of course, they couldn't. They may not have had that experience. They may not have had a son or a daughter who overdosed or a brother or husband who committed suicide, but they could relate to it because we all know a loss. And so that we change the context from my private grief, my private suffering to our communal cup of loss. And our work over the weekend is to empty somewhat, a little bit, of that communal cup of loss. We're not going to do it all in one weekend. This is not an American workshop where one time and you're done. No, many, many visitations to the grief shrine. That's why in traditional cultures, the sanity of repetition, soulful repetition of ritual, is what keeps psyche healthy. It's what keeps psyche current. The value of grief work is that it gets us current. Most of us are chewing bones that are so old that we rarely even get to turn around and face our current life, or to be in the current of electricity, of being alive, or to be in the current of the flow of life. We're almost chronically facing our histories and the histories of those who came before us. We rarely get to be here. And that's what I love about grief work, is that it slowly gets me into the current moment.
I couldn't help but think about the culture within personal development, you know, within the self-help industry that is quite pervasive around, I usually talk about the letting go of the need for the silver bullet, the golden gun, you know, and how that pursuit in many ways is the thing that's blocking us from being able to open to the falling apart that's required. You know, we've become in some ways falling apart averse, and we don't want to enter into that space. But in my own life, I mean, you know, I resisted that for such a long time, for years and years and years, until it sort of forced itself upon me. You know, life, life has a way of doing that, right? It's like, yes, the more you resist, it builds up, and then, you know, you find yourself at rock bottom eventually, because life's like, well, I tried to tell you before. I'm not too sure if it was you or someone else that I heard talk about it, but the idea that we are ancestors to someone else, and we will be ancestors to generations to come. And I want to get your take on what does it look like for us, based on this moment, based on the times that we're in, for us to be, I almost said effective ancestors, but to be, okay. Yeah, to be generative ancestors that can, you know, nourish the generations to come. And it's a big
No. It's more like the flood that comes in.
Yeah, right. You're like, there's a book and a movie that I just want to put out there. Yeah.
I think we could thread our whole conversation into this. Mm. To become an ancestor or an elder, who is an ancestor in training, means to become somebody fluent in the language of grief. You know, I talked about the apprenticeship with sorrow. In the old language of apprenticing, you undertook a prolonged study of a craft, whether that's stonework or masonry or carpentry or weaving. And you studied it for years, sometimes a decade or two. And at the end of that long devotional practice, you would be declared a master craftsman. In the apprenticeship with sorrow, that long study, the long period of working with grief and learning its contours and its textures and its style and its rhythm and its language doesn't lead to mastery. The long apprenticeship leads to elderhood. And an elder is someone who does not turn away from the sorrows of the world. And in fact, looks into the eyes, particularly of the young ones, to see whether that sorrow is coming through those eyes. And they recognize that and they speak to that. And they say, I see you. And I see what you're carrying, and I want you to tell me. An elder is someone who is willing to coax the grief of the young ones out into the world. So a lot of the grief that the young ones are carrying have no place to be deposited, no place to be heard. So it often leads to suicide or to, you know, some other form of coping. So what I'm asking for is for ourselves to become fluent enough in those skill sets. Because grief is not just an emotion, it's also a core human faculty. It's a core skill. And to become skillful in that really is what preserves the world, preserves the culture.
As you were speaking there, I mean, I almost wanted to just give that a moment to settle into my body. As you were speaking there, what came forward were the words of Rilke, and I don't remember exactly how it goes, but he's sort of talking about victory not being important to a man who seeks defeat over and over again as a means of carving ourselves. And that's almost what I hear you saying. And again, I don't have the quote word for word, but
I can help you though.
Please, yeah.
We can both paraphrase this badly. My paraphrase would go something like this. Human beings are not in the world to be victorious, but to be defeated by greater and greater things. That's the one I think you're referring to.
Yeah. And so do you feel like part of the time that we find ourselves in is that we're sort of drenched in a culture that is obsessed with victory and is trying to negate this defeat, leading us closer and closer to some sort of penultimate defeat?
Well, you know, I'll leave the language of defeat and victory to Rilke in this case, but I'd answer your question this way. I think the culture that I'm a product of has absolutely no taste or tolerance or capacity for limit. Okay. It's a subtler thing than defeat or victory, isn't it? Limit. And by limit, I also mean frailty and endings and undoings, that whole range of life that doesn't seem to be upside, right? Think, for example, about how you learned how to be grateful, principally as a kid. Where did your sense of gratitude come from? Answer is, every time something good came to you, right? That's how probably how you were trained. I mean, if things went sideways, If you fell off your bike, nobody came to you and said, well, it's an excellent learning opportunity, and you could be grateful for it, even though you didn't ask for it. I'm guessing that never happened, right? So our sense of gratitude is connected to upside. So what does that tell you about the rest of life when it comes to you? What becomes of your capacity for gratitude, including the gratitude for simply being alive? I shouldn't have said simply. I come back to that frequently because I saw so many people die. So this is not a conjectural aspect of life for me. Seeing people die is right here. It sits right here all the time. And I don't know that I've, in the last little while, had anybody come up to me and said, I just wanted to tell somebody that even though most of it's not going very well, and we seem to be in the shit in a big way, but the fact that I've lived long enough to see all this will do. At least it'll do today. Never happened. You know, when I used to have an office, the bad old days in a secretary and the whole thing, nobody ever came to my office because everything was working out. Never. Never. Nobody ever took the opportunity of good fortune to wonder about their lives. So what does it take? And being stopped is more emphatic in the life of a Westerner than stopping. I used to say when we're doing the Grief and Mystery shows, I used to say, do a riff about a road sign that I'd seen outside Chicago one time on the highway. And I realized only then, as many times I'd seen it, that it was an oracle masquerading as a road sign. It said in black letters against a red background, be prepared to stop. And I was enormously compelled for some reason when I saw it that time. And the subsequent years have turned that into an oracle indeed, a much ignored oracular presence among us, no? So it's frailty that gives you a taste for being human. I'll go further and suggest the real possibility is that your humanity only really appears when it's midwifed by frailty. And could you say two more sentences about that and then we'll go to the next question?
Sure.
Something like this. I heard the guy on the, he wrote a huge bestseller called, I think, The Brief History of Humanity or something close to that. And then he came out with a sequel, which was about the near future. I never read the book, but I heard him on an interview. And this is what came out. He said, the interviewer said, what do you see coming? He said, well, they're working on a serum. And in due course, probably too late for you, he said to him, but subsequent generation or two at the most will have recourse to a serum whereby having taken it, you won't have to die. Now listen to the prejudice. You won't have to die. I could say exactly the same thing, sort of. I could say, if you take the serum, you won't be able to die. And it puts the emphasis in the proper spot. So the interviewer said to him, wow, so you think that's a reality? Absolutely, he said. He said, well, what would that mean for us? And the author said, well, we'd have to find a new word to describe those people who took the serum because they wouldn't be human anymore as we understand the term. And the interviewer said, what would you suggest? And the author said, divine. Scary, no? Scary. Because he was riffing very clearly on our association between eternal, bottomless, omnipotent, omniscient, and the rest, and divine on the one side. That's where divinity gets its chops from. Where does humanity get its chops from? The absence of all of those things in our lives, except as rumors and allegations and carrots on the end of sticks. Our humanity comes from the fact that we end. And that's what we should be cultivating. Grace under pressure, particularly unto our endings. And a plague is a wonderful opportunity to practice this understanding.
One of the things that I really wanted to discuss with you was talking about, you know, what does it look like for us as men in these times of trouble to find a sense of purpose, to find a sense of meaning, to find a sense of contribution, or are those things even meaningful? So maybe I'll just open up with a very sort of broad question and then we'll drill down from there.
Yeah, that's such a great question. You know, when I think of that idea of a time of crisis or times of trouble and how do I respond and how do we address who we are in those moments, I think that thing that sets apart those who flower and those who wilt, perhaps, is this idea of radical acceptance. There's got to be a place where I look at the world and I see the world and I see myself in the world as I am, where I see who I am, all of me, not just the glowing, glimmering parts that I like to put on display, not just the scaffolding or the skyscraper that I like to be noticed for, but truly who I am, the totality of self. I think radical acceptance really is the differentiation point when we begin to consider how to show up in the world in times of crisis. You know, I think that word crisis is interesting. I've been turning that word over in my mind for some reason, and it traces back to a much older word, which indicates a crossroads. A crossroads. I think those crossroads, those moments of decision, that really is a crisis. A crisis offers us a moment of decision. Will I escape into fantasy? Will I escape into despair? Will I escape into blaming? Will I escape into all the things I think you named earlier as well? Will I choose to be bitter, to be broken in my response to this, or will I accept it? Will I see it for what it is? Will I address reality as it is? I think that's got to be the first step. And part of that, I think, gets to kind of what you're asking here, which is we have to see ourselves first. So how does a man respond in a time of crisis? How does a man respond in a time of trouble when the world is chaotic, when the world is overturned? Well, first of all, he has to know himself. He has to know the raw materials that he's working with.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's a very good response, but also a good launching point into probably the follow-up questions that I could hear most of my audience asking, which is where do we begin with that? Right? How do I start to see who I truly am when, you know, we have a lot of sort of psychological and cognitive blocks into viewing the truth of who we are. You know, it's really the more that I've gotten into this work, whatever modality it is, Jungian, Gestalt, you know, CPT, that kind of stuff, it's astounding how many blocks and obstacles we have to actually viewing who we are in truth, in essence. And so I'm curious to get your perspective as, you know, as you've done this work for a very long time, what are some of the natural obstacles that stand in our way? And we can talk just sort of generally as human beings, I think, unless you think that there's some particular blocks and obstacles that are specific for men. But what are some of those blocks and obstacles that prevent us from being able to witness and truly see who we are?
Yeah, I love this question. One of the things it really reveals is that the psyche, the self as we think of it, is so wired against scrutiny. Doesn't like to be seen, doesn't like to be seen straight on, and has rather ancient defense mechanisms that almost constantly come online to prevent that scrutiny. I like to think of it as sort of a large planetary body, like a planet, you know, and orbiting around that planet are these satellites that are automated, they're mechanical. And as soon as any kind of invasive force, even if it's friendly, comes in, these automatic sentries come online and begin to shoot down or take down these things. And largely, these buffers against being seen are rather uncontrollable. They take us over. They conscript us. But we're not really aware of them. Think of them as being triggered by these elements because they're so profoundly unconscious. I think that they're fairly universal. They relate to this business of being human beings. And actually, they relate a lot to things that are wired into us even before we make conscious choices. So if you think about it, we at around 3 years old, roughly learn language. Our language centers come online. Now, language has been developing throughout human history for the past 70,000 years, and we uploaded 280,000 years of human progression into that language. So by the time a three-year-old learns how to say its first few words or how to conjugate verbs and nouns and adjectives together, they're actually learning 350,000 years of human culture rather effortlessly. And I think that it reveals something of what human beings are about in really the first developmental steps of a child. At around three, the language centers come online, the human personality begins to develop, and what's one of the first things that happens to that three-year-old? They learn to lie. They start to tell untruths. And this is developmentally appropriate. I think it's hilarious, right? A child, like one of its first things is it says, I didn't do that. You know, it begins to deceive us. And why? Well, they're doing exactly what they should. They've learned that they have a self and that their self is different than yourself. And if they can use words to convince you of something that they want, then they'll get it. That's pretty highly developed functioning right there. And it is at the root of being a human being. So you talk about defensive mechanisms. This is really the mother of them. This is the first one that comes online right alongside the human personality. Lying, telling untruths, telling half-truths, or omitting the truth. That leads into other kinds of buffers, such as, I would say, suppression, such as repression. And we could define those. But I think at the root of that is this attempt to obscure or hide or avoid or deny in order to belong. And that right there is the root of these defense mechanisms. Because human programming is such where everything in us goes together to try to stay on the island. We don't want to get kicked off the island. Everything in us, for 350,000 years, probably even 2.5 million years of hominid evolution, goes into this idea of keep me in belonging to others. And in order to belong, I need to appear a certain way. So if I have to deceive, I'll do it. I'll do it. And so that really is the first of all of the defense mechanisms that keeps us from being seen as a self, from seeing ourselves.
Yeah, I love that. I love that description. And I have found that to be very accurate for the first part of my life, you know, for the first sort of 28 years, I think, which is a little bit of what we touched on in the last conversation. But certainly, you know, I've found that the urge to belong and the willingness to fabricate, omit, withhold, alter the truth, specifically around my own actions, you know, in my younger years, my teenage years, in my 20s, it was interesting because it became something that, I don't want to say this, it was maladaptive to the degree where I began to realize that I could use it to my advantage. You know, like I could talk my way out of any sort of situation, you know, when I had done something wrong or, you know, I had lied to somebody. And that was very isolating, you know, because what started to happen was I had to cut off a part of myself and withhold it from other people, which built shame and guilt and, you know, resentment and a whole bunch of other emotions. And so it became very challenging to actually know who I was. And so on this sort of notion of seeing who we are, I almost hear you making a case for starting to turn the lens around and see how we're deceiving ourselves, see how we're deceiving others, to start to admit some of those pieces. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's really the first step in polishing the mirror of self, I would say. You know, I was recently in Crete for the last month, and while I was there, I had a wonderful opportunity to sit with a gentleman I call my Zorba. Anyone who's read Zorba the Greek really, really knows this. I went to Crete specifically to write and to meet this man. Spiros was his name, and he was in so many ways just a salt of the earth guy, just a beautiful, vibrant, lively soul. And I was with him one day, and he was talking about how he interacts with people in these small villages in Crete. And he says to me, you know, the most interesting thing in any village is to talk to the priests, these old Orthodox priests. And he says, they're the most interesting because they find out everyone's secrets. And he says, everyone tells them who they're sleeping with and they shouldn't be sleeping with. And he says, and so they hold all the secrets. And this is very interesting. So he likes to go and talk to these priests. This old man enjoys that. And then he asks me this question. He says, well, who do the priests confess to, though, I think? And I said, yeah, I get that. He says, but I don't think you have this problem in the United States so much. And I said, well, I mean, some people do, but yeah, I think a lot of secular people that we don't necessarily think of those things. And he says, yeah, but you have therapists. And I kind of gasped. I thought to myself, where are you going with this? You know, and he laughs and he says, yeah, who do the therapists confess to, you know? And, you know, I didn't want to go into this larger set of explanations about, you know, every therapist has their own supervisor and et cetera, et cetera. I just kind of let him go. And he looked at me and he said, you see, I think that this is a bullshit job. He was very opinionated. And I said, okay. And he said, but that's okay because we live in a bullshit world right now. And people are always bullshitting one another. So we need bullshit functions in life. He said, like confessing to other people and talking in this way. He says, I'll tell you what I do. And now I'm on the hook. I'm like, okay, this is big stuff right here. And he looks at me and he says, I look in the mirror and I confess in the mirror and I tell myself everything about myself that might cause me shame, that might cause me guilt, that I don't like, that I wish wasn't so. And I confess it just knowing it's real. And when I can hold my own gaze, when I can see myself and not turn away from my own image, then I look at myself and I say, Spiros, you're forgiven. Now go. And I've got to tell you, I thought that was one of the most beautiful things I had ever heard. I don't think we do enough mirror work where we can actually look at ourselves. I'll tell you what I did. I came on the plane back from Greece and you know, it's like this 12-hour ride and you get kind of cagey on those flights. And so you want a new location to rest. And sometimes that's the bathroom, right? So I go to the bathroom and I'm just sitting there. I'm actually just wasting time, you know, and I have a full length mirror beside me actually, as I sit there and I look over and I see myself. And I look rather disheveled in that moment. I look like I've been to hell and back. About 7 hours into the flight. And I decide I'm going to do what he says. And I start talking to myself right there in the stall. And I start telling myself all the things I can't really stand. And I start to hold my own gaze. And I let all the words drain out of me. And I tell myself about what kind of father I think I am sometimes. And I tell myself about what kind of lover I am. And I tell myself about the thoughts I have about me and the feelings. And I tell myself until I'm blue in the face, until I can't say anything anymore. And then I notice something. And this is the strangest thing I think I've experienced. I notice how beautiful my eyes are. Now, this sounds perhaps a little self-aggrandizing, but I actually mean it quite the opposite. Because see, a lot of my life, I've actually struggled to find any beauty in my eyes. They've always looked rather drab. I've always looked kind of ordinary. I have the same eyes as my mother and my brother, and now as some of my children. Just kind of bland to me. But for some reason, I started to see my eyes, and as I caught my own attention, I suddenly thought, oh my God, these are some really spectacular eyes here. I was drawn in, and I just watched my own eyes, and I noticed a tear trickle down my face. And suddenly I realized I had hit that spot that he was talking about. I loved myself in that moment. And so I knew the medicine had done the work and I left the bathroom. But I think that that is really it. That in our world, we create so many different spaces and ways where we don't even look at ourselves. But when you can look at yourself and say the things that you would never tell a soul, maybe even your therapist, you wouldn't even tell your therapist, when you can say it and hold your own attention and look and go, oh, but this is the man or this is the woman I love. Still, me, boy, that's a powerful ground zero moment.
I really just want to set some groundwork because you do quite a bit of work around purpose, which I think we as men specifically are very intensely focused in on.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that within our culture, within Western culture especially, purpose has become this very vague, but also very broad sentiment that a lot of people can't seem to grasp. And it seems very abstract for a lot of people. And
yeah.
I was, you know, we have something called the Man Talks Alliance, and we were talking about purpose in the group. And I had done some research and found that there's like over 250,000 books on purpose, over 250,000 books on Amazon on purpose. So I preface all of this to say, I realize that what I'm about to ask you is maybe a big question, but I'm going to ask it anyways to get your perspective, which is, how do you even define what purpose is? And so let's just start with that one piece and then we'll go into the other parts after.
Well, in the simplest sense, and this is a very tangible answer, we will definitely go into the intangible. But in the simplest sense, Connor, purpose is the reason why something exists. My purpose is why I exist. You know, the tree, you know, outside my window here, the Western Red Cedar's purpose is the reason why it exists. Now, how we define the reason something exists is another question. I would agree, you know, it's very easy for us, especially as Westerners and especially as Western men, to get obsessed at times with purpose. And certainly, I think modernity here in the West tends to focus much more on the doing rather than the being. I define purpose as embodying both. So yes, what are the tangible actions, the meaningful projects, the career, all of that are going to be expressions of my purpose. But those are really, I see those as vehicles to deliver something much deeper. And that much deeper thing is our essence, you know, is our deepest being state. When we shed all of the distractions, who is it that we are when all of the distractions fall away? And to answer that question, I look at that actually as a question of connecting with soul, right? So if there's a part of me or a part of this world that knows my purpose, it is my soul. We could keep it that simple. There's trying to define soul and purpose. Yeah, I mean, in many ways, this is like a paradoxical, impossible task. But if there's a place within me that knows my purpose, then that's my soul. So how to connect with the soul? Then that I see not so much even as a spiritual process, but I see that more as an ecological process, meaning that just like when we look to the natural world, every single species, including humans, has a niche, a place, a give and a take, how they contribute and give and take from the natural ecosystem. And we as humans are the exact same way. But of course, we each have unique gifts, and it's this great process of discovering what are those and cultivating those gifts and then sharing them with the world. That's the great adventure of life. That's the great adventure of discovering our and then living our purpose and our vision. So I could say a lot more, but maybe I'll pause there.
No, I think that's well articulated, and I appreciate the distinction between the being and the doing aspect of it, because I do think that it can be easy to get caught up in purpose being a sort of level deeper version of our career. You know, it's like, oh yeah, what's my purpose? Usually when I hear men asking that, and even when I found myself asking that question, you know, years ago, what I was really asking is, what would be more rewarding for me to do with my life? Not what would be more rewarding for me to be? Who would be more rewarding for me to be? What's more possible in terms of who I am capable of being or becoming or embodying? And I appreciate the distinction that that's a part of it, right? That being is a part of it.
Yes.
Okay. So purpose, being, doing, those are integral parts of it. I'm going to ask and inquire about obstacles to purpose? What have you seen block people normally just in the work that you've done? Because you've been doing this for a number of years. What do you see most people getting hung up on, or where do they normally get blocked? What are some of the common ones?
Well, it all comes down to fear, really, right? It all comes down to fear. Fear can take lots of different forms. You know, in the healing work I do with people, and because I've had lots of experience with men's work and men's circles and therapy and all of that, you know, and that's very important, the healing journey that we all have to take. And certainly if someone's on the deep journey of connecting with purpose, then they're going to have to face themselves. And that means facing all of their power, all of their potential, as well as facing all of those wounds, all of those elements where we're not at peace with ourselves. So common blocks, I mean, in the healing work I do, it pretty much always comes back down to worthiness. Am I, at the heart of it all, it's like the core question is, am I worthy of love? Am I worthy of love? And there's lots of different forms that can take as far as blocks go, but that's what it pretty much always comes down to. So that might take the shape of, you know, low self-esteem and like, oh my gosh, who am I to have a purpose? I'm not important. You know, other people are important. Connor's important or Tim is important, but me, not me, you know. That might take the form of, even if I do find my purpose, will I have what it takes to live it? This is so big. How could I possibly step into that? It might take the form of overwhelm, like, oh my gosh, there's so much suffering in the world, and there's so many possible ways that I could help. How do I find what's mine? I mean, these are some really common ones.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I remember I interviewed a gentleman named Francis Weller.
Oh, sure.
And he said, you know, the core wound that we're all carrying is the wound of belonging, the wound of not belonging. Yep. And the 10,000 variations of not belonging, you know, that exist out there in the world, and that those become the blocks. And I'm curious, because I've in some ways stumbled my way into a sense of a purposeful life. And I don't mean to have a sort of arrogance as if like I've claimed purpose or anything like that.
Sure.
But
sure.
And when I say stumbled, I mean failed tremendously, repeatedly, and was fortunate to have mentors in my life that guided me psychologically, emotionally, in nature. And what I have found is that if I could condense how I found my way to a sense of purpose, to some semblance of purpose, was that I had to walk through pain. I had to walk through my own pain. And I had to walk through the things that I didn't want to face about myself and my past and my life and my actions.
Absolutely.
And so I'm curious to get your take on where does our human pain, our individual pain and suffering fit in on this journey towards purpose?
Well, you've probably heard of the idea that the sacred wound is one side of a coin and that the other side of that coin is the sacred gift. So, I mean, I can use myself as an example, right? For me, I was always a very sensitive individual emotionally and spiritually, right? 48, I grew up in the 80s. Being a sensitive boy was not a good thing in the fourth grade locker room, right? So for years, I was convinced, probably easily the first 20, 25 years of my life, that being sensitive was a curse, that there was something wrong with me, that this was something to hide. And later on in life, through mentoring, through ceremony, through Vision Quest and other processes, I began to see that, oh my gosh, it's the same sensitivity that allows me to connect deeply with the natural world. It's the same sensitivity that allows me to read other humans and people and groups. It's the same sensitivity that allows me to actually feel someone else's pain and be there with them in that space without needing to run away or immediately fix it or just to be with it. And over time, I began to see that, in fact, that was one of my greatest gifts. I mean, I look at myself now and I'm like, my God, I can't imagine doing the work I do without that sensitivity. I just don't think it would happen. But facing that for me was really tough. You know, it was like, wow, like, yeah, I face a lot of pain in childhood, bullied and the whole thing, you know. My parents' divorce was another example. And I didn't want to face that. Who wants to be with pain? You know, don't give me pain. Give me a Starbucks latte, you know. And yet, thanks to my mentors and my own willingness, you know, at times, there were plenty of times when I wasn't willing. And thanks to my understanding that, yes, in order to cultivate a sense of purpose, I was going to have to travel through that pain and face that and do my best to heal that. So it plays a huge role. It plays a huge role.
You had mentioned the word soul before. And so I think I just want to circle back around on that. And then I want to talk about vision quests, how they fit in, you know, where nature fits into this puzzle. What I've noticed is that as I've gone deeper down the proverbial rabbit hole of purpose and understanding existence and why we're here, and especially understanding vision quests and how they work, that word soul continues to permeate through most of the literature. And I think it's something that we mostly avoid within our culture, or it kind of gets talked about in vaguely in religious circles or, you know, sort of new age spiritual circles. So from maybe an ancient tradition or from your own perspective, where does the soul fit into this? And maybe not necessarily needing to articulate what soul actually is, because that might maybe not be helpful. If it is, please do so. But where does soul fit in to the equation of purpose?
Well, I think it was Friedrich Buechner, the theologist, that had this quote. He said that soul is that place where my deepest gladness meets the world's hunger, where my deepest gladness meets the world's hunger, which is a beautiful way to look at it. I see soul as something that's simultaneously and paradoxically both within me as well as fully infused in the entire world. It's the place where I find myself interconnected with all of life. When people make progress on the journey of a deep soul level purpose, oftentimes we call that process like a series of soul encounters or the work to cultivate connection to soul. And that can take the shape of lots of ways, right? That can take the shape of like animal encounters, like the moose experience I had. It can take the shape of dreams. The soul loves to speak through dreams, through signs, symbols, synchronicity, of realizing that there's this greater world. Yes, there's the physical world. And yes, of course, this matters. But there's also the soulful world that is right here at the same time, where on the one hand, the moose is still the moose and physically, and it has its life and there's all of that. But on the other hand, the moose was showing me something, mirroring me something back to me about myself, about my place in the world. And just as much as we yearn to find our purpose or our soul, I would offer that soul and purpose and more vision has at least as much of a yearning, if not more, to find us, right? And so this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that if indeed that's true, that if my soul, my purpose is yearning to find me, then maybe it's less about all this stuff that I do, and maybe it's more about, okay, gosh, how do I get found? How do I slow down enough? How do I shed the distractions of screen time and alcohol and, you know, workaholism, all on and on and on, enough to really get really, really still so that soul can find me.